Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi, everyone. My name is Tierney from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Ali, bon dia, kia ora and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up on the show, the bid to host COP is still up in the air, but Australia's already begun work on Plan B. It's a big day in the Kingdom of Tonga as voting gets underway for Election Day. And why is there so many hijacking of sea cucumbers in PNG? All of that and more shortly, but first, let's give acknowledgement that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, known as Melbourne. I'm your host, Aggie Dubow, and as always, Vinaka Vaka Level. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin with Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele, who says Pacific Island nations are discussing a Plan B if Australia loses its bid to host next year's United Nations Climate Summit, COP31. While a decision on hosting rights for the world's most significant climate conference is due by the end of this week, when this year's gathering, COP30 in the Brazilian city of Belém, draws to a close. However, according to some media outlets, the decision has already been made, with Nine News reporting Australia's nominated city, Adelaide, would not host the event. Australia has been unable to overcome a stalemate with a rival bidder, with Turkey, which has refused to back down despite widespread support for an event hosted in Australia in partnership with Pacific nations. Mr. Manele is also the current chair of the Pacific Islands Forum and says he's discussed a backup option with Australia's Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, this week. He tells reporter Liam Fox the proposal has three elements to give the region a prominent role at COP31 if Australia's bid is unsuccessful.
The first one is the possibility of a pre-COP leaders meeting. This is not forum leaders, but global leaders meeting. The second part is the possibility of having a pledging event during COP31. For the Pacific Resilience Facility. In September this year, the region signed the Treaty on the Establishment of the PRF, the Pacific Resilience Facility, which is based in Tonga. And we look forward to COP31, having the opportunity for us to host a pledging event so that we can get partners to capitalize the PRF. Thirdly, third part of the option is if we can have a dedicated Pacific leader that can lead negotiations in any of the streams of COP31. So these are the three components of that option.
And these are options if Australia withdraws to allow Turkey yet to host COP31, is that right?
Or if Turkey doesn't give up on its bid. We would like to ensure that our interests as a region are covered one way or the other, and we believe that that option with those components does cover some of those.
What do you think about Turkey's conduct in all of this? It seems clear that Australia's bid has the support of most of the relevant members in the organisation, but yet it's refusing to bow out. How do you and other Pacific leaders feel about that?
It would be very unfortunate if Australia loses out on the bid. I'm not sure whether there are pre-existing arrangements that Turkey has with other countries or with other partners, hence its insistence in terms of hosting COP31.
How do Pacific leaders view the importance of having COP31 in the Pacific?
As a region, it's very important for us because the impacts of climate change are very obvious. In our region, climate change is it's no longer a science. It's a reality. And hosting COP31 here would give that opportunity for other parts of the world, for other countries in the world to actually come and see for themselves the impact of climate change in our countries, in our communities. So that's why it's important for us as a region to host COP31.
And that is Solomon Islands Prime Minister and Chair of the Pacific Islands Forum, Jeremiah Manele, speaking to Liam Fox. Now, for the past 2 weeks, thousands of delegates have been gathering in the Brazilian city of Belém for the United Nations climate talks. COP30 is just shy of wrapping up, but unanswered questions remain on whether a significant agreement is achievable and over who will host next year's talks. But joining us from Belém is Kesaya Baba, Senior Manager, COP31 Strategy and Partnerships with the WWF. I say bula, Kesaya, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. I do want to start off, Kesaya, I suppose, with the latest revelation that Australia has lost its bid to host COP31 next year. I'm just wondering, what's your initial reaction and what does this actually mean now for the Pacific?
Yeah, Aggie, I believe that actually the negotiations are still ongoing at this time. I understand that that there has been some news that says that Australia has lost it. I hope I am not speaking out of turn when I say that negotiations are still ongoing. And as we just heard from the Honourable Prime Minister Manele, there are a number of options on the table that can still be worked out as well.
Yes, and I know that those reports have just been attributed to Nine News with that latest revelation. So I'm just wondering, why is it so important, though, for COP31, in your experience, to come to Australia and the Pacific?
It's an incredible opportunity to really, first of all, really center the leadership of First Nations and Pacific peoples in the climate negotiations, but also in everything that happens around the climate negotiations. I say to people that who work in climate and have been fighting for so long and may be feeling very little traction, particularly in Australia, that if COP31 were to come to Australia with all the attention and all the news and all the hopefully funding that come the close of COP31, they wouldn't have to explain to their family and friends anymore about what they're working towards. The importance of climate action will be clear, and we aim to build through that the social license for ongoing transformative policy action and also community action for climate change through that.
Now, I know that there, again, we sort of spoke about speculation, about Australia relinquishing its bid, effectively giving, hosting rights to Turkey in return for a Pacific presence. I mean, again, how much have you heard anything about this?
Well, as with most things in international negotiations, they're moving very quickly, but also very slowly. We are hearing new things all the time. But as you mentioned, Nine News, I did see that report, and we are treating that as unconfirmed still. And what we're hearing here on the ground is that there are still talks happening between Australia and Turkey, and there are opportunities where there could be an outcome that has positive benefits for all parties, including, of course, the Pacific, because Australia's bid to host COP31 is to host it in partnership with the Pacific, of course. So as Honourable Prime Minister mentioned, there's a number of options out there, but we will have to do a lot of work still, no matter what the outcome, to ensure that Indigenous leadership really remains there, and that we also, address the top issues that are really coming out from all of our conversations that I've been lucky enough to be part of, and WWF has been fortunate to be part of, where we're really hearing four key themes that we want to come out of COP31, and these could happen anywhere, but really the underlying the cross-cutting issue of centering that Indigenous leadership, but then also three other key issues, which is addressing fossil fuels and phasing out fossil fuels in a just and equitable transition. Linked to that, of course, renewable energy and the transition there, as well as nature-based solutions and making sure that we're connecting climate and nature, because they have been seen as so different in so many ways. And so we've there got those three issues of ending fossil fuel extraction and use of nature-based solutions, of the renewable energy, and underlying that Indigenous leadership and cross-cutting as well, finance, which of course is a huge and important factor of COP31 coming to the Pacific, would be the opportunity to draw attention and finance for the challenges and solutions that we know we have.
Mm. And with all of that, you know, having yourself be at COP for the past week, does it really look like countries are actually making progress towards an outcome that will benefit the Pacific?
There is a lot of work to do. So my father was actually at the, I guess you would call it the minus one COP, the Rio Earth Summit that led to the UNFCCC. He was there as an Indigenous Pacific delegate from Fiji. And, you know, the COP30 decisions that happened here, just like that one, COP30 will shape the planet for generations to come. And I hope that my child is not going to be having to come and advocate here for the same things. But if at COP30 we can reach some agreements, then that will have a huge impact on addressing, you know, achieving the Paris Agreement, and so that we can stabilize warming at 1.5 degrees. But we do see that the negotiations are deeply divided on some key issues. And the current draft texts that are coming through are weak and need a lot of improvement and work. The COP30 presidency is the one who has that role to drive this and bring agreement on these key matters too.
Yes, thank you for that, Kasaya. Well, again, if you've just tuned into Pacific Beat, my guest this morning is Kasaya Baba, Senior Manager, COP31 Strategy and Partnerships with the WWF. We are speaking, of course, the outcomes and what has been happening at COP30 for this year. Kasaya, you know, you are part of the civil society. Are you allowed to be present or actually, like, you know, share your voice during the negotiations?
The civil society delegates are generally go to COP on what we call a party overflow badge, which I know sounds really fun, but it indicates that we have been allocated a badge by the Australian government, but that we do not represent necessarily the Australian government and cannot negotiate on behalf of the Australian government. So for me in particular, I am on a party overflow badge. And so I'm able to get into the negotiations. And that is really key, particularly for civil society from the Pacific, who are providing a lot of technical support to their government delegations. It's very important that there is that access to the negotiations and to be able to observe and to pass information and advice onto governments. For those on party overflow badges, for example, for the Australian government, we work more by creating and building our relationships with the Australian government delegation and with other delegations to demonstrate support for particular issues, for particular text, and to then get into the negotiations that way.
Well, while we still have you, I do just want to reaffirm for our listeners out there that Nine News have reported Australia has lost its bid. However, there's been no formal confirmation. It's obviously still a fluid situation, and we will keep our listeners posted. Now, Kasaya, for you, what would be a really good outcome, you know, from COP30? I mean, in the sense of what would you call a success?
Yeah, I the COP31 bid is absolutely a key thing for a lot of us here, particularly from Australia and the Pacific. And there is such a lot of support for an Australian COP that is hosted, or the presidency is the most important thing, right? Not even the hosting, but there's so much support here from around the world for Australia to have the presidency in partnership with the Pacific. And so it would be an amazing outcome if there were to be a negotiation that sees Australia and the Pacific have elements of the presidency of COP31 at the very least. But we will see what the official announcement is going to be, and then the work continues. And then as for, you know, everything else that is going on at COP, we do not want to take away from the incredible work that is being done by governments and by civil society, and even by everyone who has come here, for the indigenous Amazonian peoples who demonstrated outside and inside of the COP venue this past week. We are acting in solidarity with them. And so that incredible work continues. And particularly for WWF, we see that there need to be two roadmaps. The COP30 presidency has been very focused on some roadmaps, and we would like to see two complementary roadmaps on, number one, the transition away from fossil fuels, and number two, halting and reversing deforestation by 2030. Deep, you know, in the heart of the Amazon, we want to see some agreement from parties to make sure that there are some outcomes here for forests, so that we can continue to keep those lands safe as well.
Oh, look, Isaiah, that is all the time that we have for this morning, but we really appreciate you being able to give us some insight as to what has been happening there at COP30 in Brazil. So again, thank you very much. That is a Senior Manager, COP31 Strategy and Partnerships for WWF Australia, Kisaya Baba, here on Pacific Beat. Well, away from discussions over who will be the host next year, one of the key features of this year's UN climate talks has been protests on the streets of Billum. Thousands have marched to demand stronger action from world governments to limit carbon emissions. As the ABC's Finau Fonua reports, Indigenous and Pacific activists have been working together in the name of climate action.
Thousands of people marched through the Brazilian city of Belém. Many of those marching were indigenous people from the Amazon who demanded a halt to mineral and energy operations in the Amazon jungle. Last week, dozens of indigenous Brazilian men stormed one of the COP30 venues and clashed with security. They were protesting against the Brazilian government's policy on logging, cattle farming and mineral extraction, and its impacts on their home, that being the Amazon forest. And they had the backing of Pacific Islanders.
The indigenous peoples of the Amazon are such incredible people. Their connection to land, water, is similar for us in the Pacific.
George Nadewa has worked closely with indigenous groups in Brazil. He's the Pacific Regional Organizer for 350.org, a climate action organization that has been at the of climate activism at COP meetings. Earlier this year in April, he was in Brazil to coordinate the signing of a letter with indigenous Brazilian activists calling for an urgent transition away from fossil fuels.
The struggles are the same, and it's one of survival. And this is such a great opportunity with COP. It's an opportunity for indigenous people that face the brunt of not only the climate crisis, but also of human rights violations, to be at the forefront of these negotiations.
The Amazon rainforest covers over 7 million square kilometers of land in South America and has been dubbed by scientists as the lungs of the world. That's because it absorbs large amounts of carbon dioxide and releases oxygen, a critical function for mitigating the effects of fossil fuel emissions and the greenhouse gas effect. living sustainably within this vast ecosystem are thousands of indigenous peoples whose way of life has changed little since their ancestors first arrived to South America more than 21,000 years ago. Most live a subsistent hunter-gatherer life in small villages, typically numbering no more than a few dozen people. In fact, many of them are still uncontacted by the developed world. But both illegal and state-sanctioned logging has threatened the livelihoods of these people, as well as the lungs of the world itself.
The impacts, whether from logging, are extremely harmful.
Toya Mancinari is the head of the coordination of the indigenous organizations of the Brazilian Amazon. She says indigenous peoples are at the forefront of combating the climate crisis.
Almost 80% of the world biodiversity is found in indigenous territories. We made a call for indigenous people of the Pacific to join this effort.
The link between indigenous peoples of the Pacific and the Amazon were strengthened earlier this year when the Forest Defender Camp was held in a remote village in the West Papua province of Indonesia. It saw the gathering of dozens of subsistent peoples from forests in Asia, the Pacific, Africa, and the Amazon.
Indigenous people are born with the knowledge from the ancestor who know best what to do for the future generation.
Papuan activist Francisca Rosari says the different groups talked about challenges their communities faced, like deforestation and the increasing occurrence of natural disasters.
We're trying at the end of the finalizations. For the first time, I think it's really complicated. Everyone wants to discuss about anything, what's the struggle and the issue.
At the conclusion of the Forest Defender Camp, the CIRA Declaration was signed. It called for the protection of tropical forests. With final climate negotiations underway in Belém, all eyes from the Pacific and from the Amazon are waiting for the final outcome.
And that is Final Funua with that report.
What's your favourite view where you live in the Pacific? Grab your phone or your camera and take a pic of it because Nija Daily is running a photo competition. We're looking for photos which represent you and your part of the Pacific. Anyone can enter, you don't have to be a professional, and there are prizes up for grabs. So get snapping and send us a photo in WhatsApp of your favourite view. It's +61 437 519 385. That's +61 437 519 385. And tune in to Nija Daily weekdays from 7 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia for all the details.
Thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat. We head to Papua New Guinea where the police are investigating the hijacking of sea cucumbers in the province of Daru. The incident sparked an outbreak of violence and highlighted the volatility of the industry and its dangers. Dr. Ralph Munna is a senior lecturer in the School of Natural Sciences at the University of Papua New Guinea, and he spoke to ABC's Godwin Eki about the recent heist.
We know coastal communities such as Daru depends heavily on sea cucumber income. Now, just recently, local fishermen were hijacked or held at gunpoint and sea cucumber bags were taken, causing riots on the island. This is a bit unusual. And does it have anything to do with the value of sea cucumber?
No, I think there's some sort of interest group that trying to infiltrate the sea cucumber business as a middleman, and that caused the havoc. It didn't work out well. That's why there was a problem there, and then they had to, you know, bring in all these thugs, military people there, and then went out of hand. And, you know, and I don't know whether they're trying to solve this issue right now, but I think it was trying to be hijacked by an outsider for sea cucumber trade. I think that's what I begin to understand.
What national policies guide sea cucumber management, and how effective has the national government seen sea cucumber management plan when it comes to harvesting, regulating harvest?
Well, NFA, I think it's the policy on the paper is it has no problem. What's on the paper, but nonetheless, people tend to abide with this moratorium and opening of the fisheries and the sale of the resources. So, for instance, at Daru, there are some buyers there, all right, so-called buyers, and they buy the several big companies there. They buy those resources from the fishermen, for example, lobsters and sea cucumber and other fishery products. They buy them from the fishermen, and then they export. So they are well established on the island that I know of.
And how well are the enforcement mechanisms, you know, such as compliance and surveillance when it comes to sea cucumber harvesting?
Yeah, well, you know, you have this, those companies there, and once the season is so open, people just get their products and sell it to those middlemen. And, of course, they will do the recording. They'll have to collect the data. You know, there are certain areas where they also have total allowable catch. They only have certain tonnage, certain you know, parts of the country. You don't overcatch those quotas. So once they, you know, get all this data, they will have an idea of how much is yet to be harvested, or they reach their quota. When they reach their quota, well, that means fisheries have ceased.
What is the current status of our major sea cucumber species in PNG waters, and how quickly do the exploited species recover the fisheries closures?
Well, sea cucumber is a slow-growing animals. They're just slow-growing. And then you go to a deeper waters, like then you will see other species like the white tip and the black tip. Those are the two most expensive species, and they live in reeflets where the seawater is clear and clean there. So, and they're quite expensive, and they grow very slowly to repopulate the area.
What monitoring systems are in place to monitor stock health?
I really don't know what the NFA is doing. Probably they will send some person over to actually literally go there and have a look at the stocks and do a report like what I've done in 2013. Probably they should be doing this as well, I assume.
So is there a potential to see sea cucumber aquaculture or hatchery development in PNG?
Yes, the NFA tried that. They have aquaculture center in Nago Island in KVN. I think there were one or two scientists, and they were trying to mariculture the sandfish. They were trying to transfer the technology.
How do global demand of sea cucumber influence the price and pressure in PNG?
Oh, man, it's crazy. As I said, this is the most expensive fishery. You know, now at that Canada Island, they're selling like a kilogram for 200 kina. Can you believe that? So this is the kind of incentive that people are, you know, are they ripping off of what they have done with their resources. I can say it's the most expensive fisheries in the country.
What research gaps exist in PNG's sea cucumber management?
When it comes to mariculture, as I've said, Nago Island, they're trying to mariculture the sandfish. They're trying to follow the example from Fiji. Fiji, they were doing the same thing. And then I think it's the only species that they can easily mariculture. Other species are quite difficult because their biology, too, we don't understand.
And that is Dr. Ralph Manner, a senior lecturer in the School of Natural Sciences at the University of Papua New Guinea. We go to Tonga now, where voting is underway in the country's fifth national election. More than 64,000 people are registered to vote in today's polls, but authorities expect the turnout to be lower due to the high level of migration Tonga has faced in recent years. Maren Kupo is ABC's reporter in Tonga, and she joins us on the line from Nuku'alofa. With that, I say malo tama e pongpongini, Maren.
Malo tama popongini egi malo.
Yes, wow, look, what's the atmosphere like over there on election day?
Well, egi, it's 9:30 6 here in Tonga right now. Just over 30 minutes ago, the station, the poll station, opened to the voters at around 9. They started off with a prayer before casting the votes, with voters coming in constantly here in Nuku'alofa. It's a beautiful day here, Aggie. I woke up this morning, it was raining, but now it's a beautiful sunny day. And I can also see a lot of voters coming in and out of all ages. I've seen a lot of women coming in, which is a good sign. Like you mentioned, Aggie, almost 65,000 voters should be voting today. Out of those 65,000 voters, 49% are male and 51% are female.
Mm.
And 70% of all of the voters today are from the mainland, Tonga Tapu, which is where I'm speaking to you now.
Yeah, whereabouts are you specifically, Marion? Which polling station?
I'm here at Ma'ufanga, the village of Ma'ufanga, where me and Alice Lolohea are originally from. And the poll station here is at the Catholic Church of Ma'ufanga, one of the biggest hall in this village, where it's been assigned for the voters to attend. But again, Aggie, here in Constituency 4, this is the village of Ma'ufanga, there's also other smaller halls, like community halls and also church halls, are being used for polling station today as we speak, which spreads out all around in Tonga Tapu and also in the outer islands. But here in Tonga Tapu mainland, there are 10 main polling stations mm-hmm. around the island.
Nice. Marion, as you said, it's only sort of been open, the polling stations are about half an hour or so. Have you been able to speak to any people? What are they telling you about today's election?
Well, honestly, Aggie, they're a bit scared when they see me with the camera and the mic on. They literally would just run away. I just finished speaking to one of the priests that also is the priest of this church, of this Catholic church. And he said, make sure you don't show me or talk about me when you're reporting. People are quite nervous, and I can see why, with the tension, because they are eagerly awaiting to see the results of the voting today.
You mentioned even the weather, like obviously it was rainy this morning. It's looking like it's a lot better today. Do you think that'll factor anything in today's, how people will vote today?
Well, in the past few days and week, we've been experiencing fuel shortage. Leading up to today, on my drive here to where I'm reporting from, I can still see some vehicles lining up, queuing to gas stations. And I think that will have an impact on the voting or voting attendance today, given that the government or the Prime Minister held his press conference earlier this week, assuring the public that all the gas station will be filled today and even on yesterday. But I can still see a lot of vehicles queuing up to the gas station, which might have an impact with the turning up today.
Yeah, yes. What about authorities, though? Have they faced any challenges to today's vote?
I don't see any challenges that they're facing. Before I got here, so I arrived super, super early, and then I can also see police officers being here. Just checking up on things. They're just here for security-wise, and obviously it's part of requirements from the Electoral Commission that a police officer should be present in all polling stations. So far, no, I don't see any disruptive so far. Everybody just comes in, spends 5 to 10 minutes in and out, vote, and then they leave. So, which is, it's a great sign.
And that's great to hear. So again, polling started this morning. Are you aware of when it will close? And also, Marion, what is the process for counting the votes?
So all polling stations around Tonga and also the Outer Islands will officially be closed by 4 p.m. today. And later on, it will take hours later for the electoral commissioner, Peter Vuki, to publicly announce the winners. So what I understand is all polling stations will count the winner of that station, and then will be delivered to the electoral commission. The electoral commissioner would then announce this publicly on air for everyone. And from there, then the process goes on. We won't know who our prime minister yet, because the process is, or the winners will then be officially sworn into parliament. And then from there on, the parliamentarians, the 26 members, will then select the prime minister. And then the prime minister would then select their cabinet. So the process is long. To find out who the winners are, it might take late today. But to find out who our leader or who our new prime minister is, it might take days or even weeks, Aggie.
Yes, you've already answered my question. I was going to ask, when do we expect to know, you know, which MPs or even with the prime minister? But as you said, it sounds like a very lengthy process, which we will then wait out and see. But Marian, thank you so much. Remember to go and vote, cast your vote, okay?
Yes, I would do that now.
All right. Maloa pito toko. No worries. That is Marian Kupu, ABC's reporter in Tonga. Kia ora and welcome back to Pacific Beat. It has been a pretty hectic morning. But look, now it's time to sort of reach out into the region, see what's been happening, you know, around the Pacific. And that is always brought to you by our producer, Carl Evans, who's joining me in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Aggie. Tongan elections. Are we getting COP? Is Australia not getting COP? I don't know. I'm struggling to keep up at the moment.
I know, definitely. But look, there are other stories and important things that are happening in our region, which you're bringing to us this morning. I believe New Caledonia's pro-independent bloc, the Kanaka, and the Social National Liberation Front is fracturing, with two components leaving the movement. What's happened here?
Yeah, big story this one, Aggie. So a rift has well and truly emerged with the moderate group UPM, which is a progressist union in Melanesia, announcing it has now left Flinks only 5 days after another moderate group called Palika, the Kanak Liberation Party, announced it was leaving after 41 years within the Flinks movement. So for background, Flinks is a pro-independence political group in New Caledonia, which advocates for the territory's independence from France and is a major political force within New Caledonian politics. But both groups have invoked similar reasons for wanting to leave, with UPM leader Victor Tutugoro telling local media that it was just too hard to remain in Flinks, which he says has been widely radicalised with outrage and threats. So look, really strong words there. He said both his party and Palika didn't recognise themselves anymore within the Flinks movement, which he says is operating increasingly in a sort of a violent operating mode, and particularly under the domination of Union Caledonienne and the recent recruitment of Christian Tien as its new president. Tien, who you would recognise, Aggie, is currently in France after he was arrested on criminal-related charges during those riots.
Do we actually know when Mr. Tien is going to be back in New Cal?
Yeah, well, according to RNZ, he'll be back in the territory within the next few days, and apparently returning. And we'll see what happens from there. But look, it appears he's going to be coming back to a movement which is, at the moment, tearing itself apart at the seams.
Yeah, that is really unfortunate to hear this. Okay then, well look, there's also formal negotiations that will actually start today over two uninhabited islands in between Vanuatu and New Caledonia.
That's right. The first round will start today on the sovereignty over Matthew and Hunter Islands and the permanent maritime boundaries between Vanuatu and New Caledonia within that. So these are volcanic islands claimed by both places. France via New Caledonia, I believe, currently administers the islands, but Vanuatu has never dropped its claim due to the sacred and cultural value they hold to the Nevan people. So Vanuatu PM, Jotham Napawat, he's appointed his deputy PM as the lead negotiator initiator of these talks,
saying
it's the final step in achieving complete independence for Vanuatu and formally recognising sort of the sovereignty of these islands is a key step towards that.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, a delegation from France arrived in Port Vila yesterday.
Nice. Thank you for that. All right. A health leader in New Zealand, he's actually labelled the latest Pacifica smoking rates totally unacceptable, which I'm probably not surprised by.
This is interesting as well. So this actually flies in the face of what the government was saying. They said in a press release that over the last 6 years, the Pacifica people's smoking rate has been cut in half, and that was something really to celebrate.
Mm.
However, Auckland University professor Sir Colin Tuitonga says that assessment was way too generous because Pacifica's smoking rates were still twice the rate as the rest of New Zealand. Now, the data that the minister referred to is from the latest New Zealand Health Survey, which showed that between the 2019-2020 and the 2024 and 2025 fiscal years, the Pacifica daily smoking rate decreased from 18 to 10.3% of the population. So that's pretty good. However, heavy smokers, so people who smoke daily, they actually increased their cigarette intake by a percentage point from 4.6 to 5.5 a day. So it's smoking. So it appears smoking is increasing among the people who don't want to let go of the habit. Ironically, maybe
hence
a bit of
being a habit,
maybe a bit of stubbornness there. I don't know. But ultimately, Sir Colin said, while it's an overall improvement, the decline is happening, but it's happening at a much slower rate compared to the rest of New Zealand.
Unfortunate. Okay, well, look, sport time. Flying Fijians fixture has actually been confirmed for the New Nations Championship next year.
Yes, that's right, Aggie. This is a story we've been covering all this week. Really exciting new tournament between the Southern and Northern Hemispheres. It's going to sort of encompass the best 12 teams, which is going to kick off in July 2026 from next year. Fiji and Japan will make up two of those invitational sides. Invitational meaning I think eventually they'll probably get to a point where it's like promotion, relegation,
yes.
But we'll see. But anyway, they will kick off their campaign in the Southern Hemisphere. And they'll take on Wales, then host England and Scotland in July next year. From there, they'll then head to the Northern Hemisphere at the end of the year where they'll play France, Ireland and Italy away from home. And when I say away from home, they won't actually play any home games in the Southern Hemisphere either.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see where they decide to host their home games, whether
that be
in, you know, places like the US or even Australia where there's a big Fiji diaspora.
Absolutely. That sounds like a plan, though. All right. Look, as always, Kyle, thank you so much for bringing us our headlines from around the region here on Pacific Beat. Now we head back to PNG, where the quality of health services in Papua New Guinea has been a hot topic in the current session of Parliament in Port Moresby. MPs from around the country have raised concerns about a shortage of medical supplies in hospitals and health clinics. Local media also reported that the Gujib Hospital in Jiwaka province was about to close because of a lack of funding. Papua New Guinea's health minister says faster procurement processes are needed to prevent medicine shortages. He also told the ABC's Belinda Cora that funding would be provided to Gujib to keep it operating.
But from the point of view with regards to funding, you know, medical supplies involves a wide range of people, different systems, processes, you know, funding, procurement, transportation to area medical stores. You know, we have 5 area medical stores in the country, and then it has to be again transported to all the provinces. We have 21 provinces. They have their own medical provincial transit stores. And then from there, there's involvement of different logistics companies who then deliver this product to medical supplies to the entire, in their respective primary health or rural health facilities. So there are different people who are involved and address the processes and, you know, all of those. It's reporting to different people. Companies who are now engaged with logistics, and depending on the transportation to the health facilities in the country. We have nearly 4,000 health facilities in the country. That includes 20 provincial hospitals. And apart from that, we also support the churches, church health services, who mainly support the primary health services in our country. That's Catholic health services and church health services. And on the social media, there was a question today raised in Parliament about what we are doing for Gujib. The issues are timely funding. You know, our system is that the funding, whether it's it is for health or any other programs, government funds all goes through the same process. It goes through finance, they get clearance, and they end up, many of the checks end up at the bank waiting for clearance. And then the important thing, the critical part of that, sometimes a great concern to me that I've now realized is the procurement process, not the procurement process that takes actually months. And we have a NPC or National Procurement Committee who decides when to sit and make decisions on procurement. And then the state's all, the legal clearance that comes in, and sometimes wait for state's all clearance. Going back to NEC when the contracts are actually higher than 10 million kina in our case. When the medical supplies are actually procured, that's like 6 months. It takes months. So going forward, I've actually discussed this with my department to find a section in one of our laws that allows for fast procurement process.
I understand investigations will be on foot to deal with this, but what are immediate actions taken today following the possible closure of Kutchub Nazarene Hospital in Chiwaka?
At the moment, the Chiwaka PHA or Chiwaka province does not have a level 5 provincial hospital. And since the PHA came into the arrangement of PHAs, there was something they're supposed to support the PHA, the Nazarene Hospital. We have established we will support the hospital, Nazarene Hospital, by giving them some funding. We have a meeting with the finance team today, and having a meeting with the Chiwaka team. Generally the Nazarene Hospital team, we now have a meeting today to see where we can support the hospital.
I understand that medical procurement also involves the competency of staff themselves. Has your department been able to deal with this in area medical stores?
This will be part of the investigation that we will want to do. Getting everyone who is involved in the medical supplies chain to undergo a general performance assessment. I'm aware that they've recruited several staff who are now generally doing monitoring, doing stock take for the entire medical supply chain. We have received a lot of comments, complaint on medical supplies like going missing in our medical stores and through the supply chain and generally to the at the facility level. All of this are part of the system of review. We have established a task force at the moment to support us.
And that is Elias Kapavore, PNG's Health Minister, speaking there to ABC's Belinda Cora.
In the Fale is a music show on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by me, Paola Tukefu. I'll be spinning my favourite tunes from dancehall to disco, calypso to country, reggae to roots, and hip-hop to house music, from across the eras to keep the kids and the aunties happy. If it has a pumping groove, I'll be bringing it to you to bump you into the weekend.
In the Fale, Friday afternoons at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, with Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele saying Pacific Island nations are discussing a plan B if Australia loses its bid to host next year's United Nations Climate Summit COP31.
Or if Turkey doesn't give up on its bid, we would like to ensure that our interests as a region are covered one way or the other. And we believe that that option with those components does cover some of those.
And that's Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele. You can find those top stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. But our team will be back at 6 a.m. PNG time tomorrow. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Up next, it is your news. And coming up after that, it's Nija Daily. Till next time, Odoa Fatu. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.